5. The Lusitania Fleet.
Ender says that when the war fleet from Starway's Congress reaches us, they plan to destroy this world.
Interesting.
You don't fear death?
We don't intend to be here when they arrive.
Qing Zhao was no longer the little girl whose hands had bled in secret. Her life had been transformed from the moment she was proved to be God-spoken, and in the 10 years since that day, she had come to accept the voice of the gods in her life and the role this gave her in society. She learned to accept the privileges and honors given to her as gifts actually meant for the gods. As her father taught her, she did not take on airs, but instead grew more humble as the gods and the people laid ever heavier burdens on her. She took her duties seriously and found joy in them. For the past 10 years, she had passed through a rigorous, exhilarating course of studies. Her body was shaped and trained in the company of other children, running, swimming, riding, combat with swords, combat with sticks, combat with bones. Along with other children, her memory was filled with languages. Stark, the common speech of the stars, which was typed into computers, old Chinese, which was sung in the throat and drawn in beautiful ideograms on rice paper or in fine sand, and New Chinese, which was merely spoken at the mouth and jotted down with a common alphabet on ordinary paper or in dirt. No one was surprised, except Qing Zhao herself, that she learned all these languages much more quickly and easily and thoroughly than any of the other children. Other teachers came to her alone. This was how she learned sciences and history, mathematics and music. And every week, she would go to her father and spend half a day with him, showing him all that she had learned and listening to what he said in response. His praise made her dance all the way back to her room. His mildest rebuke made her spend hours tracing wood grain lines in her schoolroom until she felt worthy to return to studying. Another part of her schooling was utterly private. She had seen for herself how Father was so strong that he could postpone his obedience to the gods. She knew that when the gods demanded a ritual of purification, the hunger, the need to obey them was so exquisite it could not be denied. And yet Father somehow denied it, long enough, at least, that his rituals were always in private. Qing Zhao longed for such strength herself, and so she began to discipline herself to delay. When the gods made her feel her oppressive unworthiness and her eyes began to search for wood grain lines or her hands began to feel unbearably filthy, she would wait, trying to concentrate on what was happening at the moment and put off obedience as long as she could. At first, it was a triumph if she managed to postpone her purification for a full minute. And when her resistance broke, the gods punished her for it by making the ritual more onerous and difficult than usual. But she refused to give up. She was Han Feizha's daughter, wasn't she? And in time, over the years, she learned what her father had learned, that one could live with the hunger, contain it, often for hours, like a bright fire encased in a box of translucent jade, a dangerous, terrible fire from the gods, burning within her heart. Then, when she was alone, she could open that box and let the fire out, not in a single terrible eruption, but slowly, gradually, filling her with light as she bowed her head and traced the lines on the floor, or bent over the sacred laver of her holy washings, quietly and methodically rubbing her hands with pumice, lye, and aloe. Thus, she converted the raging voices of the gods into a private, disciplined worship. Only at rare moments of sudden distress did she lose control and fling herself to the floor in front of a teacher or visitor. She accepted these humiliations as the gods' way of reminding her that their power over her was absolute, that her usual self-control was only permitted for their amusement. She was content with this imperfect discipline. After all, it would be presumptuous of her to equal her father's perfect self-control. His extraordinary nobility came because the gods honored him, and so did not require his public humiliation. She had done nothing to earn such honor. Last of all, her schooling included one day each week helping with the righteous labor of the common people. Righteous labor, of course, was not the work the common people did every day in their offices and factories. Righteous labor meant the back-breaking work of the rice paddies. Every man and woman and child on path had to perform this labor, bending and stooping in shin-deep water to plant and harvest the rice, or forfeit citizenship. "This is how we honor our ancestors," Father explained to her when she was little. "We show them that none of us will ever rise above doing their labor." The rice that was grown by righteous labor was considered holy. It was offered in the temples and eaten on holy days. It was placed in small bowls as offerings to the household gods. Once, when Qing Zhao was 12, the day was terribly hot, and she was eager to finish her work on a research project. "Don't make me go to the rice paddies today," she said to her teacher. "What I'm doing here is so much more important." The teacher bowed and went away. But soon Father came into her room. He carried a heavy sword, and she screamed in terror when he raised it over his head. Did he mean to kill her for having spoken so sacrilegiously? But he did not hurt her. How could she have imagined that he might? Instead, the sword came down on her computer terminal. The metal parts twisted, the plastic shattered and flew. The machine was destroyed. Father did not raise his voice. It was in the faintest whisper that he said, "First, the gods. Second, the ancestors. Third, the people. Fourth, the rulers. Last, the self." It was the clearest expression of the path. It was the reason this world was settled in the first place. She had forgotten. If she was too busy to perform righteous labor, she was not on the path. She would never forget again. And, in time, she learned to love the sun beating down on her back, the water cool and murky around her legs and hands, the stalks of the rice plants like fingers reaching up from the mud to intertwine with her fingers. Covered with muck and the rice paddies, she never felt unclean, because she knew that she was filthy in the service of the gods. Finally, at the age of 16, her schooling was finished. She had only to prove herself in a grown woman's task, one that was difficult and important enough that it could be entrusted only to one who was God-spoken. She came before the great Han Feidza in his room. Like hers, it was a large open space. Like hers, the sleeping accommodation was simple, a mat on the floor. Like hers, the room was dominated by a table with a computer terminal on it. She had never entered her father's room without seeing something floating in the display above the terminal. Diagrams, three-dimensional models, real-time simulations, words. Most commonly words, letters or ideographs floating in the air on simulated pages, moving back and forward, side to side, as Father needed to compare them. In Qing Zhao's room, all the rest of the space was empty. Since Father did not trace wood grain lines, he had no need for that much austerity. Even so, his tastes were simple. One rug, only rarely one that had much decoration to it, one low table, with one sculpture standing on it, walls bare except for one painting, and because the room was so large, each one of these things seemed almost lost, like the faint voice of someone crying out from very far away. The message of this room to visitors was clear. Han Feidza chose simplicity. One of each thing was enough for a pure soul. The message to Qing Zhao, however, was quite different, for she knew what no one outside the household realized. The rug, the table, the sculpture, and the painting were changed every day, and never in her life had she recognized any one of them. So the lesson she learned was this. A pure soul must never grow attached to any one thing. A pure soul must expose himself to new things every day. Because this was a formal occasion, she did not come and stand behind him as he worked, studying what appeared in his display, trying to guess what he was doing. This time, she came to the middle of the room and knelt on the plain rug, which was today the color of a robin's egg, with a small stain in one corner. She kept her eyes down, not even studying the stain, until Father got up from his chair and came to stand before her. Han Jingzhao, he said. Let me see the sunrise of my daughter's face. She lifted her head, looked at him, and smiled. He smiled back. What I will set before you is not an easy task, even for an experienced adult, said Father. Jingzhao bowed her head. She had expected that Father would set a hard challenge for her, and she was ready to do his will. Look at me, my Jingzhao, said Father. She lifted her head, looked into his eyes. This is not going to be a school assignment. This is a task from the real world, a task that Starways Congress has given me, on which the fate of nations and peoples and worlds may rest. Jingzhao had been tense already, but now Father was frightening her. Then you must give this task to someone who can be trusted with it, not to an untried child. You haven't been a child in years, Jingzhao. Are you ready to hear your task? Yes, Father. What do you know about the Lusitania fleet? Do you want me to tell you everything I know about it? I want you to tell me all you think matters. So, this was a kind of test, to see how well she could distill the important from the unimportant in her knowledge about a particular subject. The fleet was sent to subdue a rebellious colony on Lusitania, where laws concerning non-interference in the only known alien species had been defiantly broken. Was that enough? No. Father was still waiting. There was controversy right from the start, she said. Essays attributed to a person called Demosthenes stirred up trouble. What trouble in particular? To colony worlds, Demosthenes gave warning that the Lusitania fleet was a dangerous precedent. It would only be a matter of time before Starways Congress used force to compel their obedience too. To Catholic worlds and Catholic minorities everywhere, Demosthenes charged that Congress was trying to punish the Bishop of Lusitania for sending missionaries to the Pecaninos to save their souls from hell. To scientists, Demosthenes sent warning that the principle of independent research was at stake. A whole world was under military attack because it dared to prefer the judgment of the scientists on the scene to the judgment of bureaucrats many light years away. And to everyone, Demosthenes made claims that the Lusitania fleet carried the molecular disruption device. Of course, that is an obvious lie, but some believed it. How effective were these essays? Asked Father. I don't know. They were very effective, said Father. 15 years ago, the earliest essays to the colonies were so effective that they almost caused revolution. A near rebellion in the colonies? 15 years ago? Jingzhao knew of only one such event, but she had never realized it had anything to do with Demosthenes' essays. She blushed. That was the time of the colony charter, your first great treaty. The treaty was not mine, said Han Feidza. The treaty belonged equally to Congress and the colonies. Because of it, a terrible conflict was avoided, and the Lusitania fleet continues on its great mission. You wrote every word of the treaty, Father. In doing so, I only found expression for the wishes and desires already in the hearts of the people on both sides of the issue. I was a clerk. Jingzhao bowed her head. She knew the truth, and so did everyone else. It had been the beginning of Han Feidza's greatness. For he not only wrote the treaty, but also persuaded both sides to accept it almost without revision. Ever after that, Han Feidza had been one of the most trusted advisors to Congress. Messages arrived daily from the greatest men and women of every world. If he chose to call himself a clerk in that great undertaking, that was only because he was a man of great modesty. Jingzhao also knew that Mother was already dying as he accomplished all this work. That was the kind of man her father was, for he neglected neither his wife nor his duty. He could not save Mother's life, but he could save the lives that might have been lost in war. Jingzhao, why do you say that it is an obvious lie that the fleet is carrying the MD device? Because it would be monstrous. It would be like Ender the Xenocide, destroying an entire world. So much power has no right or reason to exist in the universe. Who taught you this? Decency taught me this, said Jingzhao. The gods made the stars and all the planets. Who is man to unmake them? But the gods also made the laws of nature that make it possible to destroy them. Who is man to refuse to receive what the gods have given? Jing Zhao was stunned to silence. She had never heard Father speak in apparent defense of any aspect of war. He loathed war in any form. I ask you again, who taught you that so much power has no right or reason to exist in the universe? It's my own idea. But that sentence is an exact quotation. Yes, from Demosthenes. But if I believe an idea, it becomes my own. You taught me that. You must be careful that you understand all the consequences of an idea before you believe it. The little doctor must never be used on Lusitania, and therefore it should not have been sent. Han Feidza nodded gravely. How do you know it must never be used? Because it would destroy the Pecaninos, a young and beautiful people who are eager to fulfill their potential as a sentient species. Another quotation. Father, have you read The Life of Human?
I have.
Then how can you doubt that the Pecaninos must be preserved?
I said I had read The Life of Human. I didn't say that I believed it.
You don't believe it?
I neither believe it nor disbelieve it. The book first appeared after the Ansible on Lusitania had been destroyed. Therefore, it is probable that the book did not originate there. And if it did not originate there, then it's fiction.
That seems particularly likely because it's signed Speaker for the Dead, which is the same name signed to the Hive Queen and the Hegemon, which are thousands of years old. Someone was obviously trying to capitalize on the reverence people feel toward those ancient works. I believe The Life of Human is true.
That's your privilege, Qing Zhao. But why do you believe it?
Because it sounded true when she read it. Could she say that to Father? Yes, she could say anything. Because when I read it, I felt that it must be true.
I see.
Now you know that I am foolish.
On the contrary, I know that you are wise.
When you hear a true story, there is a part of you that responds to it regardless of art, regardless of evidence. Let it be clumsily told, and you will still love the tale, if you love truth. Let it be the most obvious fabrication, and you will still believe whatever truth is in it, because you cannot deny truth, no matter how shabbily it is dressed. Then how is it that you don't believe The Life of Human?
I spoke unclearly. We are using two different meanings of the words truth and belief. You believe that the story is true because you responded to it from that sense of truth deep within you, but that sense of truth does not respond to a story's factuality, to whether it literally depicts a real event in the real world. Your inner sense of truth responds to a story's causality, to whether it faithfully shows the way the universe functions, the way the gods work their will among human beings.
Qing Zhao thought for only a moment, then nodded her understanding. So The Life of Human may be universally true, but specifically false. Yes, said Han Feidzi. You can read the book and gain great wisdom from it, because it is true. But is that book an accurate representation of the Pecaninos themselves? One can hardly believe that. A mammaloid species that turns into a tree when it dies? Beautiful as poetry, ludicrous as science. But can you know that either, Father?
I can't be sure, no.
Nature has done many strange things, and there is a chance that The Life of Human is genuine and true. Thus, I neither believe it nor disbelieve it. I hold it in abeyance. I wait. Yet, while I'm waiting, I don't expect Congress to treat Lusitania as if it were populated by the fanciful creatures from The Life of Human. For all we know, the Pecaninos may be deadly dangerous to us. They are aliens.
Ramen. In the story. But Ramen or Varelsa, we do not know what they are. The fleet carries the little doctor because it might be necessary to save mankind from unspeakable peril. It is not up to us to decide whether or not it should be used. Congress will decide. It is not up to us to decide whether it should have been sent. Congress has sent it. And it is certainly not up to us to decide whether it should exist. The gods have decreed that such a thing is possible and can exist. So Demosthenes was right. The MD device is with the fleet. Yes. And the government files that Demosthenes published, they were genuine? Yes. But, Father, you joined many others in claiming that they were forgeries.
Just as the gods speak only to a chosen few, so the secrets of the rulers must be known only to those who will use the knowledge properly. Demosthenes was giving powerful secrets to people who were not fit to use them wisely. And so, for the good of the people, those secrets had to be withdrawn. The only way to retrieve a secret once it is known is to replace it with a lie. Then the knowledge of the truth is once again your secret.
You're telling me that Demosthenes is not a liar and Congress is?
I am telling you that Demosthenes is the enemy of the gods. A wise ruler would never have sent the Lusitania fleet without giving it the possibility of responding to any circumstance. But Demosthenes has used his knowledge that the little doctor is with the fleet in order to try to force Congress to withdraw the fleet. Thus he wishes to take power out of the hands of those whom the gods have ordained to rule humankind. What would happen to the people if they rejected the rulers given them by the gods?
Chaos and suffering, said Qing Zhao.
History was full of times of chaos and suffering, until the gods sent strong rulers and institutions to keep order. So Demosthenes told the truth about the little doctor. Did you think the enemies of the gods could never speak the truth? I wish it were so. It would make them much easier to identify.
If we can lie in the service of the gods, what other crimes can we commit?
What is a crime?
An act that's against the law.
What law?
I see. Congress makes the law, so the law is whatever Congress says, but Congress is composed of men and women who may do good and evil.
Now you're nearer the truth. We can't do crimes in the service of Congress because Congress makes the laws, but if Congress ever became evil, then in obeying them we might also be doing evil. That is a matter of conscience. However, if that happened, Congress would surely lose the mandate of heaven, and we, the God-spoken, don't have to wait and wonder about the mandate of heaven as others do. If Congress ever loses the mandate of the gods, we will know at once.
So you lied for Congress because Congress had the mandate of heaven,
and therefore I knew that to help them keep their secret was the will of the gods for the good of the people.
Qing Zhao had never thought of Congress in quite this way before. All the history books she had studied showed Congress as the great unifier of humanity, and according to the school books, all its acts were noble. Now, though, she understood that some of its actions might not seem good, yet that didn't necessarily mean that they were not good.
I must learn from the gods, then, whether the will of Congress is also their will, she said.
Will you do that? Asked Han Feidza. Will you obey the will of Congress, even when it might seem wrong, as long as Congress has the mandate of heaven?
Are you asking for my oath?
I am.
Then yes, I will obey, as long as they have the mandate of heaven.
I had to have that oath from you to satisfy the security requirements of Congress, he said. I couldn't have given you your task without it.
He cleared his throat. But now, I ask you for another oath.
I'll give it if I can.
This oath is from... It arises from great love. Han Jing Zhao, will you serve the gods in all things, in all ways, throughout your life?
Oh, Father, we need no oath for this. Haven't the gods chosen me already and led me with their voice?
Nevertheless, I ask you for this oath.
Always, in all things, in all ways, I will serve the gods.
To her surprise, Father knelt before her and took her hands in his. Tears streamed down his cheeks.
You have lifted from my heart the heaviest burden that was ever laid there. How did I do this, Father? Before your mother died, she asked me for my promise. She said that since her entire character was expressed by her devotion to the gods, the only way I could help you to know her was to teach you also to serve the gods. All my life, I have still been afraid that I might fail, that you might turn away from the gods, that you might come to hate them, or that you might not be worthy of their voice. This struck Jing Zhao to the heart. She was always conscious of her deep unworthiness before the gods, of her filthiness in their sight, even when they weren't requiring her to watch or trace wood grain lines. Only now did she learn what was at stake, her mother's love for her. All my fears are gone now. You are a perfect daughter, my Jing Zhao. You already serve the gods well, and now, with your oath, I can be sure you'll continue forever. This will cause great rejoicing in the house in heaven where your mother dwells. Will it? In heaven they know my weakness. You, Father, you only see that I have not yet failed the gods. Mother must know how close I've come so many times, how filthy I am whenever the gods look upon me. But he seemed so full of joy that she dared not show him how much she dreaded the day when she would prove her unworthiness for all to see. So she embraced him. Still, she couldn't help asking him, Father, do you really think Mother heard me make that oath?
I hope so, said Han Feizha. If she didn't, the gods will surely save the echo of it and put it in a seashell and let her listen to it whenever she puts it to her ear.
This sort of fanciful storytelling was a game they had played together as children. Jing Zhao set aside her dread and quickly came up with an answer. No, the gods will save the touch of our embrace and weave it into a shawl which she can wear around her shoulders when winter comes to heaven. She was relieved anyway that Father had not said yes. He only hoped that Mother had heard the oath she made. Perhaps she hadn't, and so she wouldn't be so disappointed when her daughter failed. Father kissed her, then stood up. Now you are ready to hear your task, he said. He took her by the hand and led her to his table. She stood beside him when he sat on his chair. She was not much taller standing than he was sitting down. Probably she had not yet reached her adult height, but she hoped she wouldn't grow much more. She didn't want to become one of those large, hulking women who carried heavy burdens in the fields. Better to be a mouse than a hog. That's what Mu Bao had told her years ago. Father brought a star map up into the display. She recognized the area immediately. It centered on the Lusitania star system, though the scale was too small for individual planets to be visible. Lusitania is in the center, she said. Father nodded. He typed a few more commands. Now, watch this, he said. Not the display, my fingers. This, plus your voice identification, is the password that will allow you to access the information you'll need. She watched him type 4GANG. She recognized the reference at once. Her mother's ancestor of the heart had been Zheng Jing, the widow of the first communist emperor, Mao Zedong. When Zheng Jing and her allies were driven from power, the conspiracy of cowards vilified them under the name Gang of Four. Jing Zhao's mother had been a true daughter of the heart to that great martyred woman of the past. And now Jing Zhao would be able to do further honor to her mother's ancestor of the heart every time she typed the access code. It was a gracious thing for her father to arrange. In the display, there appeared many green dots. She quickly counted, almost without thinking. There were 19 of them, clustered at some distance from Lusitania, but surrounding it in most directions. Is that the Lusitania fleet? Those were their positions 5 months ago. He typed again. The green dots all disappeared. And those are their positions today. She looked for them. She couldn't find a green dot anywhere, yet Father clearly expected her to see something. Are they already at Lusitania? The ships are where you see them, said Father. 5 months ago, the fleet disappeared. Where did it go?
No one knows. Was it a mutiny? No one knows. The whole fleet? Every ship. When you say they disappeared, what do you mean?
Father glanced at her with a smile. Well done, Jing Zhao. You've asked the right question. No one saw them. They were all in deep space, so they didn't physically disappear. As far as we know, they may be moving along, still on course. They only disappeared in the sense that we lost all contact with them.
The Ansibles?
Silent. All within the same 3-minute period. No transmissions were interrupted. One would end, and then the next one never came.
Every ship's connection with every planet-side Ansible everywhere?
That's impossible. Even an explosion, if there could be one so large, but it couldn't be a single event anyway because they were so widely distributed around Lusitania.
Well, it could be, Jing Zhao. If you can imagine an event so cataclysmic, it could be that Lusitania's star became a supernova. It would be decades before we saw the flash even on the closest worlds. The trouble is that it would be the most unlikely supernova in history. Not impossible, but unlikely.
And there would have been some advance indications, some changes in the star's condition. Didn't the ship's instruments detect something?
No. That's why we don't think it was any known astronomical phenomenon. Scientists can't think of anything to explain it. So we've tried investigating it as sabotage. We've searched for penetrations of the Ansible computers. We've raked over all the personnel files from every ship, searching for some possible conspiracy among the shipboard crews. There's been cryptanalysis of every communication by every ship, searching for some kind of messages among conspirators. The military and the government have analyzed everything they can think of to analyze. The police on every planet have conducted inquiries. We've checked the background on every Ansible operator.
Even though no messages are being sent, are the Ansibles still connected?
What do you think?
Jing Zhao blushed.
Of course they would be, even if an MD device had been used against the fleet, because the Ansibles are linked by fragments of subatomic particles. They'd still be there, even if the whole starship were blown to dust.
Don't be embarrassed, Jing Zhao. The wise are not wise because they make no mistakes. They are wise because they correct their mistakes as soon as they recognize them.
However, Jing Zhao was blushing now for another reason. The hot blood was pounding in her head because it had only now dawned on her what Father's assignment for her was going to be. But that was impossible. He couldn't give to her a task that thousands of wiser, older people had already failed at.
Father, she whispered, what is my task?
She still hoped that it was some minor problem involved with the disappearance of the fleet. But she knew that her hope was in vain even before he spoke.
You must discover every possible explanation for the disappearance of the fleet, he said, and calculate the likelihood of each one. Starways Congress must be able to tell how this happened and how to make sure it will never happen again.
But, Father, said Jing Zhao, I'm only 16. Aren't there many others who are wiser than I am?
Perhaps they are all too wise to attempt the task, he said. But you are young enough not to fancy yourself wise. You are young enough to think of impossible things and discover why they might be possible. Above all, the gods speak to you with extraordinary clarity, my brilliant child, my gloriously bright.
That was what she was afraid of. That Father expected her to succeed because of the favor of the gods. He didn't understand how unworthy the gods found her, how little they liked her. And there was another problem.
What if I succeed? What if I find out where the Lusitania fleet is and restore communications? Wouldn't it then be my fault if the fleet destroyed Lusitania?
It is good that your first thought is compassion for the people of Lusitania. I assure you that Starways Congress has promised not to use the MD device unless it proves absolutely unavoidable, and that is so unlikely that I can't believe it would happen. Even if it did, though, it's Congress that must decide. As my ancestor of the heart said, Though the wise man's punishments may be light, this is not due to his compassion. Though his penalties may be severe, this is not because he is cruel. He simply follows the custom appropriate to the time. Circumstances change according to the age, and ways of dealing with them change with the circumstances. You may be sure that Starway's Congress will deal with Lusitania not according to kindness or cruelty, but according to what is necessary for the good of all humanity. And that is why we serve the rulers, because they serve the people who serve the ancestors who serve the gods.
Father, I was unworthy even to think otherwise, said Qing Zhao.
She felt her filthiness now, instead of just knowing it in her mind. She needed to wash her hands. She needed to trace a line. But she contained it. She would wait.
Whatever I do, she thought, there will be a terrible consequence. If I fail, then Father will lose honor before Congress, and therefore before all the world of Path. That would prove to many that Father isn't worthy to be chosen God of Path when he dies. Yet, if I succeed, the result might be genocide. Even though the choice belongs to Congress, I would still know that I had made such a thing possible. The responsibility would be partly mine. No matter what I do, I will be covered with failure and smeared with unworthiness. Then Father spoke to her as if the gods had shown him her heart.
Yes. You were unworthy, he said, and you continue to be unworthy in your thoughts even now.
Qing Zhao blushed and bowed her head, ashamed. Not that her thoughts had been so plainly visible to her father, but that she had had such disobedient thoughts at all. Father touched her shoulder gently with his hand.
But I believe the gods will make you worthy, said Father.
Starway's Congress has the mandate of heaven, but you are also chosen to walk your own path. You can succeed in this great work. Will you try?
I will try.
I will also fail, but that will surprise no one, least of all the gods, who know my unworthiness. All the pertinent archives have been opened up to your searching when you speak your name and type the password. If you need help, let me know.
She left Father's room with dignity and forced herself to walk slowly up the stairs to her room. Only when she was inside with the door closed did she throw herself to her knees and creep along the floor. She traced wood grain lines until she could hardly see. Her unworthiness was so great that even then she didn't quite feel clean. She went to the lavatory and scrubbed her hands until she knew the gods were satisfied. Twice the servants tried to interrupt her with meals or messages, she cared little which, but when they saw that she was communing with the gods, they bowed and quietly slipped away. It was not the washing of her hands, though, that finally made her clean. It was the moment when she drove the last vestige of uncertainty from her heart. Starway's Congress had the mandate of heaven. She must purge herself of all doubt. Whatever they meant to do with the Lusitania fleet, it was surely the will of the gods that it be accomplished. Therefore, it was her duty to help them accomplish it. And if she was in fact doing the will of the gods, then they would open a way for her to solve the problem that had been set before her. Any time she thought otherwise, any time the words of Demosthenes returned to her mind, she would have to blot them out by remembering that she would obey the rulers who have the mandate of heaven. By the time her mind was calm, her palms were raw and dotted with blood seeping up from the layers of living skin that were now so close to the surface. "This is how my understanding of the truth arises," she told herself. "If I wash away enough of my mortality, then the truth of the gods will seep upward into the light." She was clean at last. The hour was late and her eyes were tired. Nevertheless, she sat down before her terminal and began the work. "Show me summaries of all the research that has been conducted so far on the disappearance of the Lusitania fleet," she said, "starting with the most recent." Almost at once, words started appearing in the air above her terminal, page upon page, lined up like soldiers marching to the front. She would read one, then scroll it out of the way, only to have the page behind it move to the front for her to read it.
7 hours she read until she could read no more. Then she fell asleep before the terminal. Jane watches everything. She can do a million jobs and pay attention to 1,000 things at once. Neither of these capacities is infinite, but they're so much greater than our pathetic ability to think about one thing while doing another that they might as well be. She does have a sensory limitation that we don't have, however, or rather, we are her greatest limitation. She can't see or know anything that hasn't been entered as data in a computer that is tied to the great interworld network. That's less of a limitation than you might think. She has almost immediate access to the raw inputs of every starship, every satellite, every traffic control system, and almost every electronically monitored spy device in the human universe. But it does mean that she almost never witnesses lovers' quarrels, bedtime stories, classroom arguments, supper table gossip, or bitter tears privately shed. She only knows that aspect of our lives that we represent as digital information. If you asked her the exact number of human beings in the settled worlds, she would quickly give you a number based on census figures combined with birth and death probabilities in all our population groups. In most cases, she could match numbers with names, though no human could live long enough to read the list. And if you took a name you just happened to think of, Han Qingzhao, for instance, and you asked Jane, who is this person? She'd almost immediately give you the vital statistics: birthdate, citizenship, parentage, height and weight, at last medical checkup, grades in school. But that is all gratuitous information, background noise to her. She knows it's there, but it means nothing. To ask her about Han Qingzhao would be something like asking her a question about a certain molecule of water vapor in a distant cloud. The molecule is certainly there, but there's nothing special to differentiate it from the millions of others in its immediate vicinity. That was true until the moment that Han Qingzhao began to use her computer to access all the reports dealing with the disappearance of the Lusitania fleet. Then Qingzhao's name moved many levels upward in Jane's attention. Jane began to keep a log of everything that Qingzhao did with her computer, and it quickly became clear to her that Han Qingzhao, though she was only 16, meant to make serious trouble for Jane. Because Han Qingzhao, unconnected as she was to any particular bureaucracy, having no ideological axe to grind or vested interest to protect, was taking a broader and therefore more dangerous look at all the information that had been collected by every human agency. Why was it dangerous? Had Jane left clues behind that Qingzhao would find? No, of course not. Jane left no clues. She had thought of leaving some, of trying to make the disappearance of the Lusitania fleet look like sabotage or mechanical failure or some natural disaster. She had to give up on that idea, because she couldn't work up any physical clues. All she could do was leave misleading data in computer memories. None of it would ever have any physical analog in the real world, and therefore any halfway intelligent researcher would quickly realize that the clues were all faked-up data. Then he would conclude that the disappearance of the Lusitania fleet had to have been caused by some agency that had unimaginably detailed access to the computer systems that had the false data. Surely that would lead people to discover her far more quickly than if she left no evidence at all. Leaving no evidence was the best course, definitely. And until Han Qingzhao began her investigation, it had worked very well. Each investigating agency looked only in the places they usually looked. The police on many planets checked out all the known dissident groups, and in some places tortured various dissidents until they made useless confessions, at which point the interrogators filed final reports and pronounced the issue closed. The military looked for evidence of military opposition, especially alien starships, since the military had keen memories of the invasion of the buggers 3,000 years before. Scientists looked for evidence of some unexpected, invisible, astronomical phenomenon that could account for either the destruction of the fleet or the selective breakdown of Ansible communication. The politicians looked for somebody else to blame. Nobody imagined Jane, and therefore nobody found her. But Han Jingzhao was putting everything together, carefully, systematically, running precise searches on the data. She would inevitably turn up the evidence that could eventually prove and end Jane's existence. That evidence was, simply put, the lack of evidence. Nobody else could see it because nobody had ever brought an unbiased, methodical mind to the investigation. What Jane couldn't know was that Jingzhao's seemingly inhuman patience, her meticulous attention to detail, her constant rephrasing and reprogramming of computer searches, that all of these were the result of endless hours kneeling, hunched over on a wooden floor, carefully following a grain in the wood from one end of a board to the other, from one side of a room to the other. Jane couldn't begin to guess that it was the great lesson taught her by the gods that made Jingzhao her most formidable opponent. All Jane knew was that at some point, this searcher named Jingzhao would probably realize what no one else really understood, that every conceivable explanation for the disappearance of the Lusitania fleet had already been completely eliminated. At that point, only one conclusion would remain, that some force not yet encountered anywhere in the history of humankind had the power either to make a widely scattered fleet of starships disappear simultaneously, or, just as unlikely, to make that fleet's ansibles all stop functioning at once. And if that same methodical mind then started listing possible forces that might have such power, eventually, it was bound to name the one that was true. An independent entity that dwelt among, no, that was composed of, the philotic rays connecting all ansibles together. Because this idea was true, no amount of logical scrutiny or research would eliminate it. Eventually, this idea would be left standing alone, and at that point, somebody would surely act on Jingzhao's discovery and set out to destroy Jane. So Jane watched Jingzhao's research with more and more fascination. This 16-year-old daughter of Han Feizhe, who weighed 39 kilograms and stood 160 centimeters tall and was in the uppermost social and intellectual class on the Taoist Chinese world of Path, was the first human being Jane had ever found who approached the thoroughness and precision of a computer and, therefore, of Jane herself. And though Jane could conduct in an hour the search that was taking Jingzhao weeks and months to complete, the dangerous truth was that Jingzhao was performing almost exactly the search Jane herself would have conducted, and therefore, there was no reason for Jane to suppose that Jingzhao would not reach the conclusion that Jane herself would reach. Jingzhao was therefore Jane's most dangerous enemy, and Jane was helpless to stop her, at least physically. Trying to block Jingzhao's access to information would only mean leading her more quickly to the knowledge of Jane's existence. So instead of open opposition, Jane searched for another way to stop her enemy. She did not understand all of human nature, but Ender had taught her this. To stop a human being from doing something, you must find a way to make the person stop wanting to do it. 6. Varelsa.
How are you able to speak directly into Ender's mind?
Now that we know where he is, it's as natural as eating.
How did you find him? I've never been able to speak into the mind of anyone who hasn't passed into the third life.
We found him through the ansibles and the electronics connected to them. Found where his body was in space. To reach his mind, we had to reach into chaos and form a bridge.
Bridge?
A transitional entity, which partly resembled his mind and partly ours.
If you could reach his mind, why didn't you stop him from destroying you?
The human brain is very strange. Before we could make sense of what we found there, Before we could learn how to speak into that twisted space, all my sisters and mothers were gone. We continued to study his mind during all the years we waited, cocooned, until he found us. When he came, then we could speak directly to him.
What happened to the bridge you made?
We never thought about it. It's probably still out there somewhere.
The new strain of potatoes was dying. Ender saw the telltale brown circles in the leaves, the plants broken off where the stems had turned so brittle that the slightest breeze bent them till they snapped. This morning they had all been healthy. The onset of this disease was so sudden, its effect so devastating, that it could only be the Descolada virus. Ella and Novinia would be disappointed. They had such hopes for this strain of potato. Ella, Ender's stepdaughter, had been working on a gene that would cause every cell in an organism to produce three different chemicals that were known to inhibit or kill the Descolada virus. Novinia, Ender's wife, had been working on a gene that would cause cell nuclei to be impermeable to any molecule larger than one-tenth the size of the Descolada. With this strain of potato, they had spliced in both genes, and when early tests showed that both traits had taken hold, Ender had brought the seedlings to the experimental farm and planted them. He and his assistants had nurtured them for the past 6 weeks. All had seemed to be going well. If the technique had worked, it could have been adapted to all the plants and animals that the humans of Lusitania depended on for food. But the Descolada virus was too clever by half. It saw through all their stratagems, eventually. Still, 6 weeks was better than the normal 2 or 3 days. Maybe they were on the right track. Or maybe things had already gone too far. Back when Ender first arrived on Lusitania, new strains of earth-born plants and animals could last as long as 20 years in the field before the Descolada decoded their genetic molecules and tore them apart. But in recent years, the Descolada virus had apparently made a breakthrough that allowed it to decode any genetic molecule from Earth in days or even hours. These days, the only thing that allowed the human colonists to grow their plants and raise their animals was a spray that was immediately fatal to the Descolada virus. There were human colonists who wanted to spray the whole planet and wipe out the Descolada virus once and for all. Spraying a whole planet was impractical, but not impossible. There were other reasons for rejecting that option. Every form of native life absolutely depended on the Descolada in order to reproduce. That included the piggies, the pequeninos, the intelligent natives of this world whose reproductive cycle was inextricably bound up with the only native species of tree. If the Descolada virus were ever destroyed, this generation of pequeninos would be the last. It would be xenocide. So far, the idea of doing anything that would wipe out the piggies would be immediately rejected by most of the people of Milagre, the village of humans. So far. But Ender knew that many minds would change if a few more facts were widely known. For instance, only a handful of people knew that twice already the Descolada had adapted itself to the chemical they were using to kill it. Ella and Novinia had already developed several new versions of the chemical so that the next time the Descolada adapted to one viricide, they could switch immediately to another. Likewise, they had once had to change the Descolada inhibitor that kept human beings from dying of the Descolada viruses that dwelt in every human in the colony. The inhibitor was added to all the colony's food so that every human being ingested it with every meal. However, all the inhibitors and viricides worked on the same basic principles. Someday, just as the Descolada virus had learned how to adapt to earth-born genes in general, it would also learn how to handle each class of chemicals, and then it wouldn't matter how many new versions they had. The Descolada would exhaust their resources in days. Only a few people knew how precarious Milagre's survival really was. Only a few people understood how much was riding on the work that Ella and Novinia, as Lusitania's xenobiologists, were doing, how close their contest was with the Descolada, how devastating the consequences would be if they ever fell behind. Just as well. If the colonists did understand, there would be many who would say, if it's inevitable that someday the Descalada will overwhelm us, then let's wipe it out now. If that kills all the piggies, then we're sorry, but if it's us or them, we choose us. It was fine for Ender to take the long view, the philosophical perspective, and say, better for one small human colony to perish than to wipe out an entire sentient species. He knew this argument would carry no water with the humans of Lusitania. Their own lives were at stake here, and the lives of their children. It would be absurd to expect them to be willing to die for the sake of another species that they didn't understand and that few of them even liked. It would make no sense genetically. Evolution encourages only creatures who are serious about protecting their own genes. Even if the bishop himself declared it to be the will of God that the human beings of Lusitania lay down their lives for the piggies, there would be precious few who would obey. I'm not sure I could make such a sacrifice myself, thought Ender. Even though I have no children of my own, even though I have already lived through the destruction of a sentient species, even though I triggered that destruction myself, and I know what a terrible moral burden that is to bear, I'm not sure I could let my fellow human beings die, either by starvation because their food crops have been destroyed, or far more painfully by the return of the Descalada as a disease with the power to consume the human body in days. And yet, could I consent to the destruction of the Pecaninos? Could I permit another xenocide? He picked up one of the broken potato stems with its blotchy leaves. He would have to take this to Novinia, of course. Novinia would examine it, or Ella would, and they'd confirm what was already obvious, another failure. He put the potato stem into a sterile pouch.
Speaker!
It was Planter, Ender's assistant and his closest friend among the piggies. Planter was a son of the Pecanino named Human, whom Ender had taken into the third life, the tree stage of the Pecanino life cycle. Ender held up the transparent plastic pouch for Planter to see the leaves inside.
Very dead indeed, Speaker,
said Planter, with no discernible emotion. That had been the most disconcerting thing about working with Pecaninos at first. They didn't show emotions in ways that humans could easily, habitually interpret. It was one of the greatest barriers to their acceptance by most of the colonists. The piggies weren't cute or cuddly. They were merely strange. We'll try again, said Ender. I think we're getting closer.
Your wife
wants you, said Planter. The word wife, even translated into a human language like Stark, was so loaded with tension for a Pecanino that it was difficult to speak the word naturally. Planter almost screeched it. Yet the idea of wife-ness was so powerful to the Pecaninos that while they could call Novinia by her name when they spoke to her directly, when they were speaking to Novinia's husband, they could only refer to her by her title. I was just about to go see her anyway, said Ender. Would you measure and record these potatoes, please? Planter leaped straight up, like a popcorn, Ender thought. Though his face remained to human eyes expressionless, the vertical jump showed his delight. Planter loved working with the electronic equipment, both because machines fascinated him and because it added greatly to his status among the other Pecanino males. Planter immediately began unpacking the camera and its computer from the bag he always carried with him. When you're done, please prepare this isolated section for flash burning, said Ender.
Yes, yes, said Planter. Yes, yes, yes.
Ender sighed. Pecaninos got so annoyed when humans told them things that they already knew. Planter certainly knew the routine when the Descalada had adapted to a new crop. The educated virus had to be destroyed while it was still in isolation. No point in letting the whole community of Descalada viruses profit from what one strain had learned. So Ender shouldn't have reminded him. And yet that was how human beings satisfied their sense of responsibility, checking again even when they knew it was unnecessary. Planter was so busy he hardly noticed that Ender was leaving the field. When Ender was inside the isolation shed at the townward end of the field, he stripped, put his clothes in the purification box, and then did the purification dance, hands up high, arms rotating at the shoulder, turning in a circle, squatting and standing again so that no part of his body was missed by the combination of radiation and gases that filled the shed. He breathed deeply through mouth and nose, then coughed, as always, because the gases were barely within the limits of human tolerance. 3 full minutes with burning eyes and wheezing lungs while waving his arms and squatting and standing, our ritual of obeisance to the almighty Descolada. Thus we humiliate ourselves before the undisputed master of life on this planet. Finally, it was done. I've been roasted to a turn, he thought. As fresh air finally rushed into the shed, he took his clothes out of the box and put them on, still hot. As soon as he left the shed, it would be heated so that every surface was far over the proven heat tolerance of the Descolada virus. Nothing could live in that shed during this final step of purification. Next time someone came to the shed, it would be absolutely sterile. Yet Ender couldn't help but think that somehow the Descolada virus would find a way through. If not through the shed, then through the mild disruption barrier that surrounded the experimental crop area like an invisible fortress wall. Officially, no molecule larger than 100 atoms could pass through that barrier without being broken up. Fences on either side of the barrier kept humans and piggies from straying into the fatal area. But Ender had often imagined what it would be like for someone to pass through the disruption field. Every cell in the body would be killed instantly as the nucleic acids broke apart. Perhaps the body would hold together physically, but in Ender's imagination, he always saw the body crumbling into dust on the other side of the barrier, the breeze carrying it away like smoke before it could hit the ground. What made Ender most uncomfortable about the disruption barrier was that it was based on the same principle as the molecular disruption device, designed to be used against starships and missiles. It was Ender who turned it against the home planet of the buggers when he commanded the human warfleet 3,000 years ago. And it was the same weapon that was now on its way from Starways Congress to Lusitania. According to Jane, Starways Congress had already attempted to send the order to use it. She had blocked that by cutting off Ansible communications between the fleet and the rest of humanity, but there was no telling whether some overwrought ship's captain, panicked because his Ansible wasn't working, might still use it on Lusitania when he got here. Oh, it was unthinkable. But they had done it. Congress had sent the order to destroy a world, to commit xenocide. Had Ender ridden the Hive Queen in vain? Had they already forgotten? No, but it wasn't already to them. It was 3,000 years to most people. And even though Ender had written The Life of Human, it wasn't believed widely enough yet. It hadn't been embraced by the people to such a degree that Congress wouldn't dare to act against the Pecaninos. Why had they decided to do it? Probably for exactly the same purpose as the xenobiologists' disruption barrier, to isolate a dangerous infection so it couldn't spread into the wider population. Congress was probably worried about containing the plague of planetary revolt. But when the fleet reached here, with or without orders, they might be as likely to use the little doctor as the final solution to the Descolada problem. If there were no planet Lusitania, there would be no self-mutating, half-intelligent virus itching for a chance to wipe out humanity and all its works. It wasn't that long a walk from the experimental fields to the new xenobiology station. The path wound over a low hill, skirting the edge of the wood that provided father, mother, and living cemetery to this tribe of Pecaninos, and then on to the north gate in the fence that surrounded the human colony. The fence was a sore point with Ender. There was no reason for it to exist anymore, now that the policy of minimal contact between humans and Pecaninos had broken down, and both species passed freely through the gate. When Ender arrived on Lusitania, the fence was charged with a field that caused any person entering it to suffer excruciating pain. During the struggle to win the right to communicate freely with the Pecaninos, Ender's oldest stepson, Miro, was trapped in the field for several minutes, causing irreversible brain damage. Yet Miro's experience was only the most painful and immediate expression of what the fence did to the souls of the humans enclosed within it. The psycho barrier had been shot off 30 years ago. In all that time, there had been no reason to have any barrier between humans and Pecaninos. Yet the fence remained. The human colonists of Lusitania wanted it that way. They wanted the boundary between human and Pecanino to remain unbreached. That was why the xenobiology labs had been moved from their old location down by the river. If Pecaninos were to take part in the research, the lab had to be close to the fence, and all the experimental fields outside it, so that humans and Pecaninos wouldn't have occasion to confront each other unexpectedly. When Miro left to meet Valentine, Ender had thought he would return to be astonished by the great changes in the world of Lusitania. He had thought that Miro would see humans and Pecaninos living side by side, two species living in harmony. Instead, Miro would find the colony nearly unchanged. With rare exceptions, the human beings of Lusitania did not long for the close company of another species. It was a good thing that Ender had helped the Hive Queen restore the race of buggers so far from Milagre. Ender had planned to help buggers and humans gradually come to know each other. Instead, he and Novenia and their family had been forced to keep the existence of the buggers on Lusitania a close-held secret. If the human colonists couldn't deal with the mammal-like Pecaninos, it was certain that knowing about the insect-like buggers would provoke violent xenophobia almost at once. "I have too many secrets," thought Ender. "For all these years I've been a speaker for the dead, uncovering secrets and helping people to live in the light of truth. Now I no longer tell anyone half of what I know, because if I told the whole truth, there would be fear, hatred, brutality, murder, war." Not far from the gate, but outside it, stood two father trees, the one named Rooter, the other named Human, planted so that from the gate it would seem that Rooter was on the left hand, Human on the right. Human was the Pecanino whom Ender had been required to ritually kill with his own hands in order to seal the treaty between humans and Pecaninos. Then Human was reborn in cellulose and chlorophyll, finally a mature adult male able to sire children. At present, Human still had enormous prestige, not only among the piggies of this tribe, but in many other tribes as well. Ender knew that he was alive, yet seeing the tree, it was impossible for him to forget how Human had died. Ender had no trouble dealing with Human as a person, for he had spoken with this father tree many times. What he could not manage was to think of this tree as the same person he had known as the Pecanino named Human. Ender might understand intellectually that it was will and memory that made up a person's identity, and that will and memory had passed intact from the Pecanino into the father tree. But intellectual understanding did not always bring visceral belief. Human was so alien now. Yet still he was human, and he was still Ender's friend. Ender touched the bark of the tree as he passed. Then, taking a few steps out of his way, Ender walked to the older father tree named Rooter, and touched his bark also. He had never known Rooter as a Pecanino. Rooter had been killed by other hands, and his tree was already tall and well spread before Ender arrived on Lusitania. There was no sense of loss to trouble him when Ender talked to Rooter. At Rooter's base, among the roots, lay many sticks. Some had been brought here. Some were shed from Rooter's own branches. They were talking sticks. Pecaninos used them to beat a rhythm on the trunk of a father tree. The father tree would shape and reshape the hollow areas inside his own trunk to change the sound, to make a slow kind of speech. Ender could beat the rhythm, clumsily, but well enough to get words from the trees. Today, though, Ender wanted no conversation. Let Planter tell the father trees that another experiment had failed. Ender would talk to Rooter and Human later. He would talk to the Hive Queen. He would talk to Jane. He would talk to everybody. And after all the talking, they would be no closer to solving any of the problems that darkened Lusitania's future, because the solution to their problems now did not depend on talk. It depended on knowledge and action, knowledge that only other people could learn, actions that only other people could perform. There was nothing that Ender could do himself to solve anything. All he could do, all he had ever done since his final battle as a child warrior, was listen and talk. At other times, in other places, that had been enough. Not now. Many different kinds of destruction loomed over Lusitania, some of them set in motion by Ender himself. And yet not one of them could now be solved by any act or word or thought of Andrew Wiggin. Like all the other citizens of Lusitania, his future was in the hands of other people. The difference between him and them was that Ender knew all the danger, all the possible consequences of every failure or mistake. Who was more cursed, the one who died, unknowing until the very moment of his death, or the one who watched his destruction as it approached, step by step, for days and weeks and years? Ender left the father trees and walked on down the well-beaten path toward the human colony, through the gate, through the door of the xenobiology lab. The Pekinino who served as Ella's most trusted assistant, named Deaf, though he was definitely not hard of hearing, led him at once to Novinia's office, where Ella, Novinia, Quara, and Grego were already waiting. Ender held up the pouch containing the fragment of potato plant. Ella shook her head. Novinia sighed. But they didn't seem half as disappointed as Ender had expected. Clearly there was something else on their minds.
"I guess we expected that," said Novinia.
"We still had to try," said Ella.
"Why did we have to try?" demanded Grego. Novinia's youngest son, and therefore Ender's stepson, was in his mid-30s now, a brilliant scientist in his own right.
But he did seem to relish his role as devil's advocate in all the family's discussions, whether they dealt with xenobiology or the color to paint the walls.
"All we're doing by introducing these strains is teaching the Descolada how to get around every strategy we have for killing it. If we don't wipe it out soon, it'll wipe us out. And once the Descolada is gone, we can grow regular old potatoes without any of this nonsense."
"We can't!" shouted Quara.
Her vehemence surprised Ender. Quara was reluctant to speak out at the best of times. For her to speak so loudly now was out of character.
"I tell you that the Descolada is alive."
"And I tell you that a virus is a virus," said Grego.
It bothered Ender that Grego was calling for the extermination of the Descolada. It wasn't like him to so easily call for something that would destroy the Pekininos. Grego had practically grown up among the Pekinino males. He knew them better, spoke their language better than anyone.
"Children, be quiet, and let me explain this to Andrew," said Novinia. "We were discussing what to do if the potatoes failed, Ella and I, and she told me..." "No, you explain it, Ella." "It's an easy enough concept. Instead of trying to grow plants that inhibit the growth of the Descolada virus, we need to go after the virus itself."
"Right," said Grego.
"Shut up," said Quara.
"As a kindness to us all, Grego, please do as your sister has so kindly asked," said Novinia.
Ella sighed and went on.
"We can't just kill it, because that would kill all the other native life on Lusitania. So what I propose is trying to develop a new strain of Descolada that continues to act as the present virus acts in the reproductive cycles of all the Lusitanian life forms, but without the ability to adapt to new species."
"You can eliminate that part of the virus?" asked Ender.
"You can find it?"
"Not likely.
But I think I can find all the parts of the virus that are active in the piggies and in all the other plant-animal pairs, keep those, and discard everything else. Then we'd add a rudimentary reproductive ability and set up some receptors so it'll respond properly to the appropriate changes in the host bodies. Put the whole thing in a little organelle, and there we have it, a substitute for the Descolada so that the Pekininos and all the other native species are safe, while we can live without worry."
"Then you'll spray all the original Descolada virus to wipe them out?" asked Ender. "What if there's already a resistant strain?"
"No, we don't spray them, because spraying wouldn't wipe out the viruses that are already incorporated into the bodies of every Lusitanian creature. This is the really tricky part."
"As if the rest were easy," said Novinia, "making a new organelle out of nothing.
We can't just inject these organelles into a few piggies or even into all of them, because we'd also have to inject them into every other native animal and tree and blade of grass."
"Can't be done," said Ender.
"So we have to develop a mechanism to deliver the organelles universally and at the same time destroy the old Descolada viruses once and for all."
"Xenocide," said Quara.
"That's the argument," said Ella. "Quara says the Descolada is sentient."
Ender looked at his youngest stepdaughter. A sentient molecule? They have language, Andrew. When did this happen? Asked Ender. He was trying to imagine how a genetic molecule, even one as long and complex as the Descolada virus, could possibly speak. I've suspected it for a long time. I wasn't going to say anything until I was sure, but...
Which means she isn't sure, said Grego triumphantly.
But I'm almost sure now, and you can't go destroying a whole species until we know.
How do they speak? Asked Ender.
Not like us, of course, said Quara. They pass information back and forth to each other at a molecular level.
I first noticed it as I was working on the question of how the new resistant strains of the Descolada spread so quickly and replaced all the old viruses in such a short time. I couldn't solve that problem because I was asking the wrong question. They don't replace the old ones. They simply pass messages.
They throw darts, said Grego.
Well, that was my own word for it, said Quara. I didn't understand that it was speech.
Because it wasn't speech, said Grego.
That was 5 years ago, said Ender. You said the darts they send out carry the needed genes, and then all the viruses that receive the darts revise their own structure to include the new gene. Now, that's hardly language.
But that isn't the only time they send darts, said Quara. Those messenger molecules are moving in and out all the time, and most of the time they aren't incorporated into the body at all. They get read by several parts of the Descolada, and then they're passed on to another one.
This is language? Asked Grego.
Not yet, said Quara. But sometimes, after a virus reads one of these darts, it makes a new dart and sends it out. Here's the part that tells me it's a language. The front part of the new dart always begins with a molecular sequence similar to the back tag of the dart that it's answering. It holds the thread of the conversation together.
Conversation, said Grego scornfully.
Be quiet or die, said Ella. Even after all these years, Ender realized Ella's voice still had the power to curb Grego's snottiness, sometimes at least.
I've tracked some of these conversations for as many as 100 statements and answers. Most of them die out much sooner than that. A few of them are incorporated into the main body of the virus. But here's the most interesting thing. It's completely voluntary. Sometimes one virus will pick up that dart and keep it, while most of the others don't. Sometimes most of the viruses will keep a particular dart. But the area where they incorporate these message darts is exactly that area that has been hardest to map. It's hardest to map because it isn't part of their structure. It's their memory. And individuals are all different from each other. They also tend to weed out a few memory fragments when they've taken on too many darts.
This is all fascinating, said Grego, but it isn't science. There are plenty of explanations for these darts and the random bonding and shedding.
Not random, said Quara.
None of this is language, said Grego.
Ender ignored the argument, because Jane was whispering in his ear through the jewel-like transceiver he wore there. She spoke to him more rarely now than in years past. He listened carefully, taking nothing for granted.
She's onto something, Jane said. I've looked at her research, and there's something going on here that doesn't happen with any other subcellular creature. I've run many different analyses on the data, and the more I simulate and test this particular behavior of the Descolada, the less it looks like genetic coding, and the more it looks like language. At the moment, we can't rule out the possibility that it is voluntary.
When Ender turned his attention back to the argument, Grego was speaking.
Why do we have to turn everything we haven't figured out yet into some kind of mystical experience?
Grego closed his eyes and intoned.
I have found new life! I have found new life! Stop it! Shouted Quara.
This is getting out of hand, said Novenia. Grego, try to keep this at the level of rational discussion.
It's hard to, when the whole thing is so irrational.
A te, a Jorakem, ya imagino microbiologista que se torna enamorada de una molécula.
Whoever heard of a microbiologist getting a crush on a molecule?
Enough, said Novenia sharply. Quara is as much a scientist as you are. And
she was, murmured Grego.
And if you'll kindly shut up long enough to hear me out, she has a right to be heard.
Novenia was quite angry now, but as usual, Grego seemed unimpressed.
You should know by now, Grego, that it's often the ideas that sound most absurd and counterintuitive at first that later cause fundamental shifts in the way we see the world.
Do you really think this is one of those basic discoveries? Asked Grego, looking them in the eye, each in turn.
A talking virus?
Se quella sabe tanto, porque ela now dis o que a quelles bichos disem?
If she knows so much about it, why doesn't she tell us what these little beasts are saying? It was a sign that the discussion was getting out of hand, that he broke into Portuguese instead of speaking in Stark, the language of science and diplomacy.
Does it matter? Asked Ender. Matter, said Quara.
Ella looked at Ender with consternation.
It's only the difference between curing a dangerous disease and destroying an entire sentient species. I think it matters.
I meant, said Ender patiently,
does it matter whether we know what they're saying?
No, said Quara. We'll probably never understand their language, but that doesn't change the fact that they're sentient.
What do viruses and human beings have to say to each other anyway?
How about, please stop trying to kill us, said Grego. If you can figure out how to say that in virus language, then this might be useful.
But, Grego, said Quara with mock sweetness, do we say that to them, or do they say that to us?
We don't have to decide today, said Ender. We can afford to wait a while.
How do you know, said Grego? How do you know that tomorrow afternoon we won't all wake up itching and hurting and puking and burning up with fever and finally dying because overnight the Descolada virus figured out how to wipe us out once and for all? It's us or them.
I think Grego just showed us why we have to wait, said Ender.
Did you hear how he talked about the Descolada?
It figures out how to wipe us out. Even he thinks the Descolada has a will and makes decisions.
That's just a figure of speech, said Grego.
We've all been talking that way, said Ender. And thinking that way, too, because we all feel it, that we're at war with the Descolada, that it's more than just fighting off a disease. It's like we have an intelligent, resourceful enemy who keeps countering all our moves. In all the history of medical research, no one has ever fought a disease that had so many ways to defeat the strategies used against it.
Only because nobody's been fighting a germ with such an oversized and complex genetic molecule, said Grego.
Exactly, said Ender.
This is a one-of-a-kind virus, and so it may have abilities we've never imagined in any species less structurally complex than a vertebrate.
For a moment, Ender's words hung in the air, answered by silence. For a moment, Ender imagined that he might have served a useful function in this meeting after all, that as a mere talker he might have won some kind of agreement. Grego soon disabused him of this idea.
Even if Quara's right, even if she's dead on, and the Descolada viruses all have doctorates of philosophy and keep publishing dissertations on screwing up humans till they're dead, what then? Do we all roll over and play dead because the virus that's trying to kill us all is so damn smart?
Novenia answered calmly, I think Quara needs to continue with her research, and we need to give her more resources to do it, while Ella continues with hers.
It was Quara who objected this time. Why should I bother trying to understand them if the rest of you are still working on ways to kill them?
That's a good question, Quara, said Novenia. On the other hand, why should you bother trying to understand them if they suddenly figure out a way to get past all our chemical barriers and kill us all?
Us or them, muttered Grego.
Novenia had made a good decision, Ender knew. Keep both lines of research open and decide later when they knew more. In the meantime, Quara and Grego were both missing the point, both assuming that everything hinged on whether or not the Descolada was sentient.
Even if they're sentient, said Ender, that doesn't mean they're sacrosanct. It all depends whether they're Raman or Varelsa. If they're Raman, if we can understand them and they can understand us well enough to work out a way of living together, then fine. We'll be safe, they'll be safe.
The great peacemaker plans to sign a treaty with a molecule? Asked Grego. Ender ignored his mocking tone. On the other hand, if they're trying to destroy us and we can't find a way to communicate with them, then they're Varelsa, sentient aliens, but implacably hostile and dangerous. Varelsa are aliens we can't live with. Varelsa are aliens with whom we are naturally and permanently engaged in a war to the death,
and at that time our only moral choice is to do all that's necessary to win. Right, said Grego. Despite her brother's triumphant tone, Quara had listened to Ender's words, weighed them, and now gave a tentative nod. As long as we don't start from the assumption that they're Varelsa, said Quara. And even then, maybe there's a middle way, said Ender. Maybe Ella can find a way to replace all the Descalada viruses without destroying this memory and language thing. No, said Quara, once again fervent. You can't. You don't even have the right to leave them their memories and take away their ability to adapt. That would be like them giving all of us frontal lobotomies. If it's war, then it's war. Kill them, but don't leave them their memories while stealing their will. It doesn't matter, said Ella. It can't be done. As it is, I think I've set myself an impossible task. Operating on the Descalada isn't easy, not like examining and operating on an animal. How do I anesthetize the molecule so that it doesn't heal itself while I'm halfway through the amputation? Maybe the Descalada isn't much on physics, but it's a hell of a lot better than I am at molecular surgery. So far, said Ender. So far, we don't know anything, said Grego. Except that the Descalada is trying as hard as it can to kill us all, while we're still trying to figure out whether we ought to fight back. I'll sit tight for a while longer, but not forever. What about the piggies? Asked Quara. Don't they have a right to vote on whether we transform the molecule that not only allows them to reproduce, but probably created them as a sentient species in the first place? This thing is trying to kill us, said Ender. As long as the solution Ella comes up with can wipe out the virus without interfering with the reproductive cycle of the piggies, then I don't think they have any right to object. Maybe they'd feel different about that. Then maybe they'd better not find out what we're doing, said Grego. We don't tell people, human or Pecanino, about the research we're doing here, said Novinia sharply. It could cause terrible misunderstandings that could lead to violence and death. So we humans are the judges of all other creatures, said Quara. No, Quara. We scientists are gathering information, said Novinia. Until we've gathered enough, nobody can judge anything. So the secrecy rule goes for everybody here, Quara and Grego both. You tell no one until I say so, and I won't say so until we know more. Until you say so? Asked Grego impudently. Or until the speaker for the dead says so. I'm the head xenobiologist, said Novinia. The decision on when we know enough is mine alone. Is that understood? She waited for everyone there to assent. They all did. Novinia stood up. The meeting was over. Quara and Grego left almost immediately. Novinia gave Ender a kiss on the cheek and then ushered him and Ella out of her office. Ender lingered in the lab to talk to Ella,